Welcome to Clareton Conversation. My name is Katie Esbester, and our guest today is Eliki Brain. Eliki Brain is an experienced artist, photographer, author, and educator. While she was taught at Oxford and UCL, among others, she now lectures at Camberwell College of Arts and is art historian for the National Gallery. Although she is most notable for her successful solo and group exhibitions, she has also won awards for her photography, including the Salon Art Prize, and was nominee for the Max Mara Art Prize. She has a forthcoming show, a solo show, in Birmingham at the Argentia Art Gallery in April 2020. Welcome to the show, Eliki.
Thank you. Hello.
This is an impressive CV, but really what I suppose most has brought you to many people's attention who wouldn't necessarily follow the career of an avant-garde artist such as yourself is the recent court case where you sued, was it the National Gallery?
That's right, yes. I was involved along with 26 others in a legal battle at Employment Tribunal, a group of us who had been working for the National Gallery as their educators for many years, found ourselves without a job and unfortunately had to fight for our rights to be treated well in a national institution.
Okay, so how did this happen? What do you mean you had to fight for your job? You're employed by the National Gallery.
We had an unsettled or unclarified working status. We believed we were at the very least workers for the National Gallery, at the very best employees. The gallery, as the HR department, believed we were self-employed and actually were just contractors. And we ended up...
like Uber.
Exactly. So we ended up fighting a very similar battle to Uber drivers and Deliveroo deliverers we were taxed at source and yet denied any employment benefits.
That's shocking. Absolutely shocking.
It was shocking, but the court filed in our favour, the tribunal found in our favour. So we've now the court case has been finished and we're very happy that we've managed to resume our relationship with the National Gallery. But it is shocking that unfortunately today, like so many other workers in other fields, workers in the arts, which we often think are free from misbehaviour, or we hope them to be free from misbehaviour, sometimes, unfortunately, behave with the same tactics as big corporations.
As far as the message I'm taking from this is that if the big corporations get away with it, the Deliveroo and the Ubers and all the other, zero-hour contracts, and then our big national institutions will as well.
I think, unfortunately, that is the case. Poor practice, unfortunately, is pervasive in today's culture. But I think it's easy to forget and overlook workers in the cultural sector. I think we're traditionally seen as being very fortunate because most people working in the arts don't do it solely for the money, but do it for the pleasure and for the respect they have for their craft and for their subject.
But this is a boomerang, Eliki. This is not a boomerang. This is this attitude that somehow we're the lucky among the lucky.
Absolutely.
It's a big problem because it means you can exploit people.
I couldn't agree more.
And you can look them dead in the eye and say, well, I'd like to pay you, but...
but I can't.
But I can't be... yeah. And you have no right to ask for payment because you're in the creative industry.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think there's this sense that anyone who is creative is doing it purely for pleasure. And I see that...
we live on air. and the bank gives us our house for free. We don't need a mortgage.
Absolutely.
Sainsbury's donates food and we don't have to buy our food.
I think that's very true, sadly. And while, I do consider myself fortunate for being totally engaged and in love with all aspects of my work, it is still my work. And I find the most telling is in my own environment and direct family where there is a misunderstanding as to what my work is. Everybody seems to think it's, in the upper middle classes, in the educated middle classes, think it's vital that their children get taken to art galleries and get shown artworks by artists in the museums as part of their education. And yet they think that if I'm an artist, I'm somehow... not supplying something that's useful. So there's a sort of a disconnect between our desire to make sure art is available and our understanding that actually artists need to live and don't live on air.
Well, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
No, we've tried to prove this time and again. Unfortunately, that's not always visible in today's society.
Yeah, and I also think that if you know, this is kind of united we stand, divided we fall. You know, if people like you and your co-workers, your colleagues at the National Gallery take on the National Gallery and win, and Uber drivers take on Uber and win, it starts becoming demonstration effect. Like, don't even think about it, people.
Absolutely.
Like, and don't even think about treating our workers badly.
Totally.
And then that has a domino effect.
I think that's absolutely what happened in our case. You know, we felt very frightened and, you know, indeed had to, you know, there is no legal aid anymore to speak of. So we had to crowdfund. We initially funded this this tribunal battle ourselves and then had to crowdfund in order to get the funds, in order to prove our own legal status as workers, which really should have been a job for our employer, not for the employee. But having stood fast, and, you know, I must congratulate the rest of my colleagues, one in particular, two of us really sort of worked, we all worked extremely hard to get to tribunal, to see tribunal through, to get the public behind us and financially support this cause. But the outcome has been hugely positive. We found that in our own industry, many museums have just taken a good hard look at the contracts they dish out. I know from many colleagues across different creative fields that there's definitely been a shift whereby people are thinking twice about using these sort of rogue employment strategies in our industries. And many were very surprised that, you know, 27 humble art historians and artists could take on an institution like the National Gallery and be successful and win. And that's given a lot of people hope. And it's we know that the case, which is known as A Brain versus the National Gallery, is being used and frequently cited now in other employment cases. And I'm very proud to have put my name towards this.
Hey, congratulations. And on behalf of Common Decency, thank you. You know, that's
you're all very welcome.
I really think that this is not just something that affects us in the creative industry. I think it affects our society at the widest level.
Absolutely, we know that, you know, workers, whether they are employed or self-employed, are being increasingly badly treated. There has been an absolute slip in the recent decades. When it comes to work, the working people's rights.
Yeah, shocking. Let us move on, though, from this extraordinary political and success that you have achieved and actually go back to you, the human being, Aliki. Tell us a bit about yourself. Where do you come from?
So anyone hearing my name will sort of combined with my accent will no doubt have a question mark in their mind. I'm called Aliki, which is a Greek name. It's the Greek for Alice, and my family name, although it sounds very British, Brain, is actually a French family name, Brenne. My parents had no idea that I would end up becoming an English speaker and settling in England when they gave me the name Aliki Brain. My grandfather was Greek. My parents are French, but I was brought up in many different places. My father was a French diplomat, and I was brought up in Algeria, Holland, Germany. So I had a very peripatetic childhood, and ended up in Britain. Initially, going to a big private boarding school to finish my schooling in my late teens, and then from there stayed in England to study, and have never really gone back to France. So I'm sort of a true European, yes, I've chosen to settle here, and in the process have lost any trace of my French accent.
Well, I think we live in London. I mean, the wonderful thing about London is that, you know, people come from all over and become Londoners.
I think that's right. I feel very much a European Londoner.
Yes. You know, people ask me, where do I come from? I say, I'm Canadian, but I'm also a Londoner.
Yeah.
I'm a Londoner now.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like you're similar. You come from all over and
absolutely,
you're a Londoner.
Absolutely. And London has given me a very, very warm welcome, I must say. I've been here for nearly 20 years, and I feel very at home here.
Oh, yes, it's home then. It's just absolutely its home.
Absolutely.
So, Leaky, how did you fall in love with art, or did it find you, or what happened? What was the process by which you came across this? Perhaps. Now, I just should say, Leaky, I ask all my guests this question. Was there a particular work of art or a particular event, maybe, or an art exhibit or some kind of encounter with art that made you think, this is what I want?
I think there was a series of encounter at a particular time in my life when I was quite young. My parents were relocated to The Hague, and we spent many afternoons of the weekends being dragged around art galleries. But I do remember being taken around the Maritshuis in The Hague, aged about 8 or 9, and seeing Vermeer's little Delft Street. And, you know, I'm not the first creative to take note of that painting and its little section of yellow wall. But I remember being told that the story afraid I've forgotten the writer's name. Is it Stendhal who falls in love with the little yellow street in Vermeer's street? but I remember being told this story of this by my father, of this very famous writer who has palpitations and has a turn in front of this work of art. And I don't think I was having a turn in front of that work of art, but I wanted to have a turn in front of a work of art. And I imagine this would be a good thing. But I do remember seeing some de Koonings as a child, again in Holland at about the same period of my life, and really wanting to be an artist. I didn't
from
think,
that moment.
Yeah. You know, I was very young. I was 9 or 10. I think there were several different labels I gave myself as a future grown-up. I initially wanted to be an opera singer. I wanted to then be a sculptor, and I've ended up being an artist who works with photography. But there was never any doubt that I was only ever going to be someone who creates things. My spelling
that was
and my
just in the warp and woof of your
absolutely,
being.
Absolutely, and I really struggled at school until I was in my late teens. I kept sort of failing school years and being moved back.
This expensive posh private boarding school. you weren't achieving. Didn't your parents say let's save some money and put her in a local comprehensive?
Well, I was in day schools until I was 17. I didn't move to England to go to a big posh boarding school. I went to Marlborough for 2 years. And until then, yeah, I did really struggle. I think, sadly, I was very, very hard of hearing, but wasn't diagnosed. I am very hard of hearing, but wasn't diagnosed until my early 40s. So I think that probably didn't help, that I couldn't hear what was being said in class.
I just briefly want to go back to the Maritshuis, because I want to tell you about my experience going to the Maritshuis. Because for those of you who have not been to this museum, my own personal feeling is a little bit of museum goes a long way. I don't really need to spend hours there. The Maritshuis is an exception, possibly because it's so small. It's some rich old guy's house.
Correct,
that Mr. Maritz, one would assume.
Yes.
And he either had an extraordinary eye for art or just had blind luck, and he created a bunch of Vermeers, bought a bunch of Vermeers, including Girl with a Pearl Earring. Like you talked about the street when Vermeer painted his own street, but you know, I think probably Girl with the Pearl Earring is probably one of the more famous paintings.
Absolutely,
that
I'm sure.
Inspired novels, including by Tracy Chevalier, and it also has the Goldfinch, which inspired the book by Donna Tartt.
Quite right. Yes.
Yeah. So you walk up the stairs, and poof, there is the painting of the Goldfinch, and then you turn the corner and poof, there's the painting of the Girl with the Pearl Earring. And you turn another corner and there is the street in Delft. It's the most, and then you're done. Because there's only so many paintings in that. Because your house is only so big. It's only a museum. It's probably one of my very favorite museums is the Maritshuis for that reason.
Absolutely. I think it transports you back, you know, because it's a house. And I think that's the case with other similar museums. If you've ever visited Rembrandt's house, or Rubens' house in Antwerp, you get that feeling that you could nearly live with those works. I think that's why museums in homes, even if they are reconstructed into museums, give you that sense that these objects are not for the consumptions of kings or worshippers, but for the consumptions of individuals going about their daily lives. And I think that's what's so gripping about seeing those works in those circumstances.
Yes, I agree. And there is something about the interplay between art and location, so that the art informs the location forms the art. And, you know, this is the complexity of artistic understanding, is that it's not just about the art, in my opinion. It's about when you come across it. It's about, you know, if you're in a lousy mood and your kids are screaming, good Lord, you know, the last thing you want to do is go to an art gallery and you're stuck going to it because you got friends visiting from another country. And it's like, oh, let's go to Tate Britain. And it's like, oh, let's not.
Yeah. I mean, I think somewhere like here in London, something like the Wallace Collection or the John Soane Museum give you that sense where you can just dip in, because actually you're just walking through someone's home and you can fantasize it being your home for a short while.
Yes. It doesn't take much imagination.
Exactly.
Yeah, which
is
always good for me because I'm not inherently terrifically imaginative. Okay, so you've graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. You now know you're going on an artistic career. You've had all these extraordinary achievements. How did you put it all together?
So, you know, I left art school. I was at the Ruskin at Oxford University. I did a 3-year BA in fine arts. And when I left, I remember making a very decisive decision in my own mind that I was going to have to earn a living. Well, that was a practical concern, but as I was going to have to earn a living, and as I would, I had a sense that I would find the art world, in inverted commas, rather difficult, and I don't think I was going to be a natural fit, that really the only thing that was going to make me an artist, which was absolutely my intention, was to keep making art. And I set up my life and my career in such a way that I could earn a living in quite a separate manner. I became a teacher, and I've always earned a living teaching, initially in a primary school, and then working for Museum Education Department, which is where my very long-standing relationship with the National Gallery began. I then started teaching for on a more freelance basis for other London museums and galleries, and eventually got a position as a lecturer, initially at Westminster University and currently at Camberwell College of Art, part of UAL. And throughout that time, so for the last 20 years since I left college, I just continued making my work independently from what I was doing during the day. So I had my studio at home, and I just plodded on, you know, determinedly. And I was very fortunate that I always had enough going on as an artist to keep me going. So I had enough small exhibitions, initially group shows and then solo shows in more impressive galleries. More books and articles were being written about my work as time progressed. But I always had the sense that the only thing that was important wasn't to cultivate relationships with galleries or attend as many private views as I could, or, you know, do that dreadful thing, this idea of networking. Instead, I just made my work, and I made the work just for me. I didn't have a collector or a gallery wall in mind. I just made the work I wanted to make. And that's stood me in good stead.
Good for you. It because, you know, we do get conflicting in, you know, how to go about surviving in the creative industry is no mean feat. And it sounds to me like you've kind of married a pragmatic reality that you had to earn a living with the pragmatic reality that as a result, you wouldn't have much spare time and energy. So the spare time and energy you had to focus it on your artwork.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I often tell my students, and I've recently started being asked to be a mentor to more established younger artists, you know, and I find myself saying, you know, the great luxury of earning your living not from your artwork is that you're completely free to make the work you want to make. And not having any financial considerations in mind when you make the work is likewise helpful. I think it makes you a more committed and a more focused artist. I also tell my students that art schools really is the one time to make your rubbish artwork. You know, get it all out your system while you're doing your degree, because you have the time and space to do it. Yeah. You know, when you only have a few hours after your children have gone to bed and the laundry's been hung, you sure as hell are not going to make a duff piece of work. You know, you're going to make your best work. You haven't got time to play. Now, sometimes it is important to stop and have that period of playfulness where you experiment as an artist. But most of the time, most of us don't have that luxury. But I think very established artists, I think I sometimes see in very successful, financially successful artistic careers, a sense that the work is becoming a little bit flat. It's just, you know, it makes it easier to make bad work, I think, if you have that luxury of extra time.
This is an extraordinary tension at play here, though, Aliki, and I'm glad that you've been able to resolve it. But I'm, you know, and I say this to authors and people who ask me, you know, you're a publisher, Katie, what do I need to do to get published? And I say, write. Mm. You know, like, don't wait for the muse to hit. If you wait for the muse to strike and to speak to you and tell you what words to put in the page, you'll never get anything published. A writer gets up in the morning and writes, has lunch, writes, has dinner, writes, go to bed. You know, it's a job. Mm. And you approach it with a discipline and a self-respect that this is something that you do with your time, as opposed to kind of endlessly pausing to reflect about whether or not you're in the mood, whether or not you can do this.
Yeah, no, I recognize that very much. And of course, it is a balancing act between the hours that I have to spend teaching. Now, very luckily, increasingly, as I now teach to a university, you know, to an academic diary, you do get sort of moments of calmer time. You know, my teaching tends to fit within term time, which makes family life also very organized. That works well for us. And when I am quote unquote on holiday, and I'm fortunate in one way in that my young children, I'm divorced, so my young children go off to be with their dad for a chunk of those holidays. Mm-hmm. I do wake up and I go to the studio and I'm at work. You know, it's a different kind of work, but it is work. And I try during term time to also sort of ring fence moments of time where it is like a 9-to-5. But the reality, I think, perhaps particularly for women, is that often that ring-fenced amount of time is at the tail end and at the very beginning of the day, when the world is quiet. You know, I scurry off to make work, or at least to think about the work to be making.
Of course, yeah. I can remember once listening to a long interview of, with John Cage, the American composer, avant-garde American composer.
Who was a taxi driver,
wasn't he? He was a taxi driver,
in New York.
And so when he did Einstein on the Beach, he was still driving a taxi, and he would get up in the morning and take his kid to school and drive his taxi all day, pick up his kid from school, take him home, and then go compose until midnight. Then get up in the morning and take his kid to school. And
absolutely.
It was like almost such a rigid schedule that you go, whoa, like that is... And it's that pragmaticism that, I wouldn't say it's that hard reality that people don't tell youngsters when they go into the creative world, that you've got to have a pragmatic reality here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think I was helped by the fact that, you know, I wanted a very, you know, I think people are sometimes puzzled by the fact that, you know, I'm an artist. They have this vision of an artist being sort of rather flaky and you know, I think there are all kinds of people who are creative. And in my case, I'm very straight-laced and very rigorous, and I like order and discipline in my own life. So that pragmaticism comes very naturally to me.
Yes, like John Cage. But I can remember once hearing Margaret Atwood interviewed. And this is in the younger days when she was not the international superstar that she is now, but a Canadian superstar. And whenever you needed a quote for anything about writing, you went to Margaret Atwood. And they said to her, how many hours a day do you write? And she said, 9. And they said, yeah, but no, I mean, we mean on a daily basis. She goes, yeah, I know, 9. And she, and it was a, you know, the kind of, this is the And she had a similar organization that you're talking about, where she limited the amount of hours that she did at other things so she could
Do
it with
the
writing.
This
is a theme, actually, that runs through all the creative arts, is trying to get how do you go about doing the work of being creative, the work of being creative, you know? And we have this kind of Vincent van Gogh, the tortured genius.
He was very much a 9 to 5, if not a 6 to 6 or 6 to midnight. That's what I say to people. If you want to be an artist, make art. That's the only thing you're supposed to be doing. There are other people to do the other jobs. There are gallerists, there are curators, mm-hmm. there are publishers, there are impresarios. But if you want to make art, and I think, along with pragmatism and hard work, also comes a desire for success and a conviction about your work, a determination. And I don't mean that, this idea of wanting to be successful, this idea of ambition sometimes sits rather uncomfortably. But I think it's important to note that, at least in my case, my ambition isn't about myself. I'm not ambitious to become a celebrated artist. I'm ambitious for my work to become celebrated and work.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something that people in the creative industry sometimes, or at least young people entering the creative industry, need to be quite clear about. There are two different ways of achieving success. One is success for yourself or success for your work. And in my case, I'm very much part of the latter. And I think great work is made by people who are determined and want great work and respect for their practice, not for themselves.
Well, that's an extraordinary idea if you just expressed it, Leek. Yeah, I have to admit, I completely agree with you. Can I ask you, if you can answer this question, you may not be able to, if there's any single work that you've done that you think has been your greatest contribution to the artistic world to date? Keeping in mind, you're actually...
artist still.
Yes, I was going to say, you're quite a young woman. And, so I appreciate the fact that you've got another 40 years of producing art here before...
So I've clocked about 25 years of making. No, I think the big...
Maybe you could show us one of your pieces of artwork and show someone that you're most proud of. Or maybe something in the coming, and maybe get a sneak preview for your solo show in Birmingham this April 2020.
Yeah.
Is that permitted?
That is absolutely permitted. So I think the work that really transformed the way I make work is a body of work called The Hunt. And I actually remember very, very distinctly being about to fall asleep and having an idea for a piece of work and quickly making I've got paper and pencils and by my bed, or at least I've got a phone that you can write on, Or at least most people now have some tool or device to make notes. And I made a little drawing to remind myself. I was worried I'd forget. For many years, I worked, my work is photographic, but I wouldn't describe myself as a photographer. I happen to use a camera and photographic film and photographic images to make my large images. And my practice for many years was about cutting into the prints and really think about the prints as objects. But one of the eureka moments in my practice was to decide no longer to work on the surface of the print, but instead to work on the negative directly, so that the print would remain a clean, smooth, finished photographic print. There's no sense that it's been in any way manipulated. It's just a photograph on the mm-hmm. wall. Mm-hmm. But I started hole punching my negatives using an ordinary sort of hole punch that you might use before you put a piece of paper in your folder. And I hole punched my prints and took a negative, a photograph of a woodland, and hole punched it in order to mimic a historical artwork of The Hunt, an image, a very celebrated image today in Oxford's Ashmolean Museum by Paolo Uccello. And so what I did is I used different size punches and made these holes in the negative, which when printed read as black tears or marks on the image.
So before we take a look at this image, we're just going to hear a word from our sponsor.
Everything written needs an editor. As Stephen King once said, to write is human, to edit is divine. Could be a memoir you wrote about growing up, or a collection of grandma's recipes, or a copy for business statements, or a racing page turner that you want to present to agents. For highly experienced and professional editing at a reasonable price, contact Clapham Publishing, www.claphampublishing.com, for all your writing needs.
Welcome back to Claritin Conversation. Our guest today is Aliki Brain, the celebrated artist who's fought battles on behalf of all of us for greater employee rights, worker rights. And we're now just discussing her seminal work of art that kind of changed her artistic path. It's called The Hunt. And I'm looking at it right now, and it's a black and white photo of a forest, of a woodland, with voids in it, little black holes, which Aliki has hole punched the negative to create. It's quite unusual. It's an unusual photograph because it doesn't quite look like anything else I've ever seen before, and yet it's perfectly recognizable as a woodland. What was the response, Aliki, when you produced this photograph? Were you able to? What does one do? Sell it?
Yeah. So this work was shown in a number of exhibitions. Actually, it's been quite successful. So it was made as part of a broader practice using my hole puncher on negatives. And this work was initially shown in London at the London Art Fair. So initially shown at the London Art Fair, and then subsequently has travelled to Vienna, where it was shown, and then has also more recently been shown in a museum just outside Lausanne, in the Musée of Puy.
It's getting around.
So it is getting around. It's one of there are three in the series, and although they've been very well displayed. They've, as you say, they've really very well travelled works. They have also been written about and reproduced in a number of publications, both books and journals on contemporary art. Unfortunately, no one's bought them, which I only say is unfortunate because it means these very, very large works, the works nearly 3 meters across in size, one has to live permanently on my living room wall, as there's no other storage available, and as we live on a fifth floor and it doesn't fit in our lift, every time it does travel, palpitations are high, watching art handlers sort of take it down, maneuver it precariously down huge flights of stairs.
Sounds like some kind of a Laurel and Hardy routine, remember when they tried to get the piano up the flight of stairs?
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I can't watch. I have to confess that the last time this work went off, indeed to Lausanne, I left the house with my children and had breakfast outside so that the Swiss art handlers and could be supervised by my husband. I couldn't be in the room to watch the potential of the breakage of this very unwieldy image.
I sympathise. Aliki, you've got your forthcoming work, the solo show in Birmingham in April. What kind of work are you going to be showing there?
So the hole punch has made a reappearance. So this strategy of cutting into the negative was for many years then sort of evolved into other kind of often sometimes described by a very dear mentor, academic and artist in his own right, John Hilliard, a very celebrated artist here in Britain, once commented that my strategies for making work were rather, quote, stupid. He meant it in the nicest possible way.
How could that possibly be nice?
Oh, well, it's just there's something very ridiculously effortless in the way that I make my work. I use very straightforward strategies that you sort of would associate much more with sort of the arts and crafts of young children. I use stickers, hole punching, and folding. to make my work. So it's very serious work, but it does have this very playful element to it. And although the prints are large, slick, finished product, the way they're made does involve me literally taking one of my negatives and folding it, putting a fold in it. Just a few months ago, I started returning to my hole punch, but instead of printing what was left of the negative once I'd made hole punches in it, I collected the little tiny negative confetti and put those in the enlarger to make large prints. And that will be the body of work that will be shown.
I love how innovative this is.
It's Birmingham.
Hard not to be charmed by the fact that you've turned what one would think would be kind of your recycling rubbish, you know, the stuff that comes out of your hole punch, into artwork. You know, it's turning everything inside out.
I think that's right. And that's what I'm interested in. I want us to really reconsider how photography is a very invisible medium. What I mean by that is that we don't see a photograph, we see the image that the photograph carries. And that's no longer true of painting. We understand since the advent of abstraction that we have both paint and we have the image that the paint carries. Mm-hmm. Whereas in photography, that's always been very hard to take notice of. You know, when we talk about a photograph, or indeed if we talk about a painting with a realist subject, we don't say, "Oh, look, there is a picture of a glass of water." We just say, "Oh, look, there's a glass of water." Mm. And with photography, I think that becomes very much second nature. We forget that photography isn't real; it's just an image of the real.
Do you think that Photoshop is changing that? Because now we recognize the fact that every image you see could easily be photoshopped,
manipulated in some way.
I think it's school-age children.
Absolutely,
do it now.
And I think people working with photographic images have always known that. I mean, early photography in the 19th century has always been manipulated. You know, some of the very first photographs were composed of many different negatives. They were, you know, using photography as an artist would use paint to make their images. But yes, I think the general consciousness, the general public has now got a truer understanding of what a photograph is, that it is, a construct. And that's in part what my work has always been about. But this body of work that I'll be showing in Birmingham is literally made from very, very tiny little bits of negative.
Okay, I'm just taking a look at it now. And I can see it almost looks like suns in the sky. And, you know, a kind of, it almost looks... I mean, I'm working books, so forgive me for saying it this way. It looks like a book cover from a science fiction and fantasy series where you have multiple moons in the sky. And this is all you need is a dragon going overhead, and you've got, yeah. This is a fantasy novel. But it's very, very pretty, I'm surprised, because you don't tend to think of rubbish as being pretty. But this is a very pretty image you've created. It's an abstraction, but it's very aesthetically pleasing.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
It may not have been your intent.
No, absolutely. I think they're both playful and beautiful and dark. I mean, because there's so little negative, the majority of the image is jet black. But the little sort of, as you describe them, the little moons or suns are tiny circular bits of negative, and they're very tiny. They're only about 3 millimeters in diameter, which have been punched out of a photograph of cherry blossom.
So they are
sort of like the cherry blossom that's up in the tree that will fall as petals within an instant.
Uh-huh.
They have that quality of sort of ephemeral and falling.
Well, this is
spectre.
Very, very. There are layers of meaning to this, then.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
I think like every image, there is the meaning that's brought about by the material that's being used, by the way the material is made visible, and then by the message and the narrative that the image itself carries. I think good work of art sort of engages on all those different levels.
Fantastic. Congratulations on that. I look forward to reading the reviews of your work.
Thank you.
And I recommend anybody who happens to be in Birmingham in April in 2020 to go to the Argentea Gallery to go see Aliki Brain's work. And thank you for, again, once again, thank you for the striking a blow for workers' rights.
you're all very welcome.
And good luck with your next endeavour.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Claret in Conversation was brought to you by our sponsor, Clapham Publishing Services. It was executive produced, sound recorded, and edited by Teddy et Hooft. If you liked Claret in Conversation, please subscribe, share, and comment.